Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is one of an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Over the past 10 years, Richmond's cultural art scene has been quietly growing, attracting numerous talented artists with national and international reputations. Twice a month, on the first and third Mondays, we will sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we're having lunch with Steve Vitello. Steve, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, too.
Before we got started, we were kidding around a little bit and talking about Get Smart, which was, for those of you too young to remember, was about a guy who was a secret agent, I guess, who had a phone in his shoe.
Exactly. It was a super klutz.
Yes, and he was a super klutz. And I was talking about, you know, sound in the studio and that kind of thing, or trying to get good sound in a cafe or whatever. And you mentioned the cone of silence.
Exactly, yeah, because Max was a special agent, and whenever he would meet with the chief, he would sort of call for the cone of silence, which was this clear plastic shell that would come over their head and keep the sound in. Although I always remember, at least as I remember it, they would then have to scream at each other because it also cut off sound from each other inside. But, you know.
All right, so we for those of you hard of hearing, you'll really enjoy this show because we're going to have the cone of silence descend on
precisely,
us
but then
and
we
start
have to
screaming at each other.
Yeah, exactly.
But you also mentioned something I thought was interesting. You said, and this also had some basic beginnings of an influence on the work that you do. So talk about your work. You're a sound artist.
I'm a sound artist, which is different in my mind and many people's minds from being a musician or composer. And a very simple definition is to describe sound art as being something between visual art and music. Most often it's sort of installation-based. I'm represented by a commercial gallery in New York and another gallery in Paris. And so I make, you know, gallery shows, but in which sound is what's the central attention or central focus, sometimes with the visual, sometimes without. But it's much more about sound in space than, let's say, music would be more sound in time.
And how did Get Smart get you started on this?
I don't know. It's always easy to look back at those childhood moments and say, you know, the feedback created by my baby monitor was the breakthrough. But you know, really what happened is I grew up in New York. I played in punk rock bands when I was 14 in the late 70s. I played in whatever post-punk and noise bands and rock bands in the 80s. And then started to collaborate with video artists in the late 80s and to do soundtracks. And I started to find myself to be actually a much more interesting musician, a much more interesting sound maker than I had been as a straight guitar player. And sort of working with visual artists, and I got to work with some incredible people as well as choreographers.
Who'd you work with?
Very first person I ever worked with was Tony Ausler, who's well known for his, he makes, for example, these dolls with a person's face projected onto the doll head. And,
oh, okay. I know. Yes. I've seen
that
work.
He's one of the like major figures in sort of contemporary video at the moment. I worked with Namjoon Paik a great deal, Jem Cohen, a filmmaker, Eder Santos in Brazil.
And what were you doing with these people?
You know, I was creating soundtracks, and it was very much a collaborative process. It's not, you know, working with video artists or working with choreographers is very different, I think, than a straight, you know, let's say commercial gig where someone creates an edit of a picture and says, okay, put sound on top of it. This was much more being part of a process. So someone was doing an installation based on video shot in Death Valley. They also brought me to Death Valley to record ambience, animals, wind, sand going by. And so working with them, I'd get into their process and start to learn, you know, how they constructed images or environments. And over about 10 years, I just accumulated an enormous amount of experience and ideas and sort of, you know, borrowed what I could from each of the people I had worked with and also started to see that I was also changing their work.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the interplay? I mean, so you're, let me see if I can understand this. You're out there in Death Valley, for instance. Dressed up as a secret agent, right?
Actually, we were dressed up as a Brazilian golf team.
Because
then we got a 50% discount at the hotel.
Are you serious?
Yeah, totally
really?
Serious. Yeah, yeah. And actually,
why didn't I think a Brazilian golf team? No, what does a Brazilian golf team look like?
It's, well, we had very, very big They're Brazilian sun hats, but they look like giant sombreros.
Right.
And, yeah, and actually, Bob Kapitoff, who's my boss at VCU, was then living in Berkeley, and he was the producer for the project. And Eder Santos from Brazil got us together, but Bob was the one who worked out the 50% discount based on being a golf team.
So did a golf team in Death Valley?
Yeah.
Is there a golf course out there?
Yep.
Oh, there is?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
Golfers get, you know.
I guess
like ladies' night, it was, you know, special golfers get half off or something.
Did you have to have golf clubs?
We didn't go that far.
No?
No. But, you know, you can always check in the hotel and say they're in the car.
Right.
And, you know, all those microphones.
With my sound equipment. Yeah, that looks like a microphone, but it's really a golf club.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so there you were masquerading as a Brazilian
golfer.
Mm-hmm. And what was your day like? What were you doing besides not playing golf?
We would get up at about 5 in the morning, and we would go out and start recording, and Eder would be shooting video. Bob would be shooting video, and I was either recording sound or shooting Super 8 film with a nice little Super 8 camera. And, you know,
So you're recording the same sound that they're hearing? Or are you recording different sound?
Yeah, but it's either one. It's not, you know, I mean, I think working the way that I've always worked, it's more about a poetic connection. It's not like a documentary where here you have the image and here you have the whispering sounds. It's just more gathering a kind of parallel ambience or a parallel set of material. And quite often the way
Stand on its own.
Mine could stand on its own. Although I think the best ones in those projects were the ones where mine couldn't stand without the other, where and his couldn't stand without mine. You know, that really, especially within video art, which I think is even different than film, but that you're aiming towards something that's really like a synthesis and a interconnected sort of set of elements.
This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Indie Radio, radio for the rest of us.
Can you? I mean, is it possible to talk about it on the radio in terms of what it was you were attempting to do, or was it more of a fluid that it was evolving as you were doing it?
I think, you know, I mean, this is that one project going back to 92 or something.
Oh, okay.
But it was really... It was about capturing an emotional experience that then I could apply to sound. And you know, what happened, I mean, just to put that in the timeline, is that about 10 years of working with artists got me to the point in the late 90s where then I sort of stepped off as no longer a composer who worked with video artists or choreographers, but suddenly becoming my own person and kind of at first my own so-called composer, but then very quickly becoming an installation artist.
Mm-hmm.
But those experiences, like going to Death Valley, it was very much about gathering material that, just like Eder Santos was shooting film and video that he was then going to manipulate and create something out of, I was gathering sound that I was going to then manipulate and structure. And a lot of what I did was sort of look at how different visual artists, video artists processed their images or how they created nonlinear narratives or... you know, just sort of did different kinds of manipulation and tried to, in a certain way, emulate that. So mm-hmm. if Tony Ausler had these, you know, an installation of a oil drum with this very sickly green paint dripping down it, I started to think, well, in a certain way, it made me think of a very strangely tuned instrument. And I kind of got ideas based on the colors. And so that was very different than working with...
What was he trying to do with the image? Do you know?
He was doing this at that time. A lot of his work was about toxicity.
Okay, that's right.
And so he would, let's say, have this oil drum, and there would be a video projected into the oil spill,
mm-hmm.
and there would be words that were somewhat historically connected to a specific place. But it was also, again, a sort of poetic twist on the
right. So if I asked you to hum a bar, or to
see, I'm terrible. It's funny. It would almost seem like I'm tone deaf if I hummed a bar. Although on the other hand, I have a very good sense of remembering melody and putting it back. I've just never learned to train my voice.
So the sounds that you're talking about are these all sounds that come from the environment? Are these sounds that you create or these sounds you collect? As I was coming down to scoop you up today in front of the library, I heard a construction site. And I thought to myself, well, noise, Well, music. Mm-hmm. You know, and I guess sort of in a sense, life is that way in terms of, you know, it's our perception of how we perceive things that really mm-hmm. is our experience, not what it is independent of us. Mm-hmm. So where does this, do you call it music? Mm-hmm. What do you call it?
You know, depending on what I'm doing, I've made, there's probably about 15 CDs of my sound work that have come out. And those I tend to more often think about as music. And sometimes there's recognizable instruments in there. There's the last CD that I had come out on New Albion Records had electronics, but also slide guitar and piano. The installations, though, I think of not so much as music as being as sound art.
When you say installation, I don't know that everybody listening knows what that means. Tell them what that means.
Well, you know, that you come into a gallery space and that, whereas usually, let's say there's a sculpture and that's the physical form. I'm more interested in the gallery in sound as a physical form, that you come in and there's a number of speakers or there's a number of objects producing sound, and that your encounter is the sound rather than the visual, and that the way that you encounter the sound changes your sense of the environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the project that I'm most well known for is the recordings I did in the World Trade Center in 1999. I had a 6-month residency, it's almost not so different than Plant Zero in terms of most of the people had these kind of semi-separated cubicles.
Right.
Because I was one of the first media artists, they thought, well, his equipment is more expensive than the painter's. So, myself, along with two still now very successful artists named Kevin and Jennifer McCoy, we had our own separate suite where we could go in and lock our doors. We had 24-hour access. And my project was about, I put contact microphones on the windows, which are kind of like a stethoscope. It picks
right.
up vibration.
Right.
And when I got there, I was on the 91st floor. It was unbelievable looking, but it felt almost artificial.
What do you mean?
And, well, you were so high up, but it looked like you were coming into a movie screen with the sound switched off. And there was a little hiss from the ventilators, but otherwise it was very silent. There's triple mm-hmm. density windows. And by bringing the sound from outside into the space, you suddenly became, you know, just aware of different kinds of sound that the building actually experienced. You know, and it was always different. It could be thunderous. It could be cars. It could be planes. It could be quiet. But once you heard that, there was days you heard the building moving, creaking. And for me, it was interesting sound in itself, but it was also even more interesting sound tied to the space and the site and giving you a
sense.
Why
was this interesting to you? I mean, if I'm listening, mm-hmm. and I don't know anything about sound mm-hmm. art, and someone tells me they put microphones on a window, mm-hmm. and they thought those sounds were interesting, I'm thinking, really?
You know, it depends on context. Mm-hmm. I think, sure, you know, if we were just to stick our head out the window here,
right.
we'd say, all right, we're passing traffic. But to hear the world from a different space, to hear it from that far above ground, uh-huh. and, it, you know, there was days that it would sound like, one of the first times ever someone said it sounded like an orchestra tuning up. And the fact that there was actually a natural set of occurrences acting on a steel and glass structure, that kind of the earth, you know, in our
space. So investigating, mm-hmm. I mean, essentially to most people that sound didn't exist, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly.
So you're investigating mm-hmm. a sound within now, obviously, a very mm-hmm. famous building.
Sure.
Well, it's famous then, but now infamous, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And so the interest to mm-hmm. you is investigating or experiencing sound that may not otherwise be experienced.
Exactly. Or maybe taking something that's considered sort of background noise. I mean, sometimes insult to my work which is actually equally the compliment, is someone will say, oh, well, you create the ambient sound. And actually what I'm interested in is taking what other people consider ambient, which to me implies background.
Right.
And finding something within it that
right.
I want to foreground.
Okay.
And giving you a new appreciation, you know, just like
of that perception.
Yeah, exactly.
Of that sound perception.
Yeah, and sometimes it's urban, sometimes it's rural.
Because we live in a very noisy world, yes?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, and so most of us, our first response, I guess, is to, I know, is to try and tune it out.
Precisely.
I mean, let's tune out all this noise.
Exactly.
And you're saying, no, let's peel away some of these layers. This may be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone just told me, I did a talk at MoMA a couple weeks ago.
MoMA being
Museum of Modern Art in New York. Someone came up to me at VCU and said his friend had seen it. And he said, you know, he thought you didn't actually talk like an artist. You talked more like an archaeologist.
Yes, yes. That's what I was sitting here thinking. You're really exploring.
And my background is, you know, I mean, I'm now teaching in an art school, but I have no theoretical background or even necessarily theoretical interest. I mean, I sort of, I'm more interested in the kind of exploration and discovery and revealing that discovery. And it's the same way I teach. But, you know, I've also been in the very deep Amazon doing a project with the Yanomami Indians.
Oh, really?
So it's not to say everything is city-based.
Well, let's talk about that in a minute, but let me just tell folks that what they're listening to here is sound, actually, and hopefully sound that's interesting to you. This is Tim Bowring. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM Indie Radio, radio for the rest of us. And we're talking with Steve Vitello today, who really is a sound explorer. Is that fair?
I would take it, sure.
Yeah? I mean, it's, you know, probably, we could probably work on it and come up with something that sounds a little better, but, exploration of sound? Maybe.
Maybe.
Anyway, you were talking about a project you were doing in the Amazon, working with Indians, which sounds like it might be interesting, but let's peel it away and see. What was that about?
That was, you know, probably a once in a lifetime experience, as many of these things are. But I was commissioned by the Cartier Foundation, a museum in Paris, to go into the Amazon. And there was an anthropologist that the museum was working with, and he brought the idea of doing a project around shamanism and the shamans who are...
This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Indie Radio, radio for the rest of us.
So we were talking about this project that I did in the Brazilian Amazon.
Yeah, you were talking about a project that you've done with Indian, and I guess Indian, for lack of a better word. Just tell me a little bit about that.
So it was a commission from a museum in Paris called the Cartier Foundation. They were working with an anthropologist who had studied the Yanomami, one of the last hunting and gathering tribes in the world, and who's, you know, been documented a great deal through anthropology. But his idea was to work with a small group of artists doing projects about shamanism and sort of the specific village in which this group of Yanomami people lived and their culture. And so five artists were sent down there separately. Gary Hill, one of the major video artists, was there. A Brazilian painter and sculptor named Adriana Varejo.
Was the Brazilian golf team there?
No Brazilian golf team. By that,
at this point,
it's 10 years later.
Hard to find the ball in the Amazon anyway.
Infighting,
once you hit it.
Yeah, a lot of infighting. So, so in any case, I was flown in a little Cessna plane the size of, you know, my bedroom, and brought in to stay with the Yanomami for about six, seven days, and to do recording with and around them. I slept in the village, you know, in a hammock with them. The village was basically a large hut, which was open in the middle. They followed me when I went to do sound recordings. There was always one or two guys with a bow and arrow in case a large killer jaguar hopped out and decided to eat me, which is a real danger.
Which would have been a really great sound.
It would have been great. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, right.
But then the black box thing. But they were constantly, they were also, you know, hunting. As I would be going and suddenly they'd look up, point an arrow into the trees. I'd see nothing. And then a monkey would fall to the ground.
Really?
And that was dinner. But I did about 17 hours of recordings and actually learned.
What were you recording? You weren't recording them.
Well, that was the thing, is primarily I was recording the forest, but the eldest shaman in the village became very interested in me, and he would come over and put his arm on my shoulder very heavily and start talking to me and gesturing to the forest. And I remember, you know, the anthropologist was always translating, but even he looked really surprised. I think it was the second morning. And I said, you know, what's he telling you? And he said, well, he's telling you about their experience of sound, which is something that I've never known about before. And they have the shaman have a term called heya, which has to do with the sounds that they hear in the forest and what it tells them.
Yeah.
Like a kind of prophecy. You know, it may have to do with the next visitor who's going to come to the village. It may have to do with spirits. It may have to do with fruit that's ripe. It may have to do with, sorry.
So was he trying to point you in the direction of sounds he thought were of?
Sort of. I mean, he was sort of telling me the significance of the sounds that he
really?
Was hearing. And one morning I woke up at about 6:30. He said, oh, it's too late. You woke up so late. The animals came down from the mountain and wanted to be captured by this thing of yours, being the tape
really?
Recorder.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there was all sorts of kind of surreal. Remember, there was this howling
wind. So
he was
really, he was getting not only, I mean, it was almost like, in a sense, the news to him
mm-hmm.
from the sounds
Absolutely.
He was getting from there was allowing him to predict what was coming.
And at times.
And also to make sense of what was going on.
Exactly.
And that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And it was absolutely, you know, it's not. As he spoke it was not mysterious, it just is. And mm-hmm. I remember there was this howling sound, and I thought it was the wind coming off the mountain, which, of course, was actually the howler monkeys waking up.
Mm.
But those kind of things I would sort of recognize, but through his own culture, he would also decode these sounds for me. So the
sounds had meanings?
They had meanings.
And as you more you studied this, mm-hmm. the more did you find that there were just multiple meanings?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it was also, I mean, it was, in a sense, it was the only place I've ever been in my life where you heard no machinery, no airplanes, no traffic, but it was also a very dense forest.
Mm-hmm.
And so hearing these different meanings simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And also, as he would tell me the stories, he would also not tell me, let's say, the name of the animal. He would mimic the sound that it makes.
Really?
So I included his
voice. Did you get that on tape?
Yeah, I did. And I included, in the installation, basically you come into a very dark room. And there's one speaker in the ceiling in each corner, so basically four speakers. And those speakers represent the sounds of the forest over mm-hmm. a 24-hour period. But and then in the center of the room facing
well,
down.
Well, not just mm-hmm. did you just run them for not?
No,
I mean, this was edited, right?
Yeah, it was edited.
Yeah, okay.
But it was
right.
sort of a representation of getting to this little creek at 5 in the morning and the sounds, and then the way the sounds change as the light uh-huh. comes up. The cicadas who take over in the midday, the frogs who come in later. But then in the center of the room, you heard sounds from the village, and mostly the shaman named Lorival, as he would tell you different stories. And it wasn't translated, but just the texture of his voice is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were listening, you also heard him making the sounds of birds, of monkeys,
mm-hmm.
of an arrow flying through the air.
Right.
And
so sound mm-hmm. is enormously important because of the forest being so dense, I would guess.
For sure.
If you can only see 3 feet in front of you,
mm-hmm.
sound really...
Mm-hmm.
becomes a guiding
it is it's how you hunt
light.
It's how you hunt for animals. It's how you know if neighbors are coming or you know a,
right.
an enemy is coming. It's how you know if the weather is changing,
right?
You know.
Interesting. That's really fascinating. Well, I'm bringing you dragging you kicking and screaming mm. into the 21st century. You are
darn
currently have an installation at the Olympics.
I do, and it's part of what's called the Cultural Olympics. And my understanding is that there's always these artistic commissions that go on around the Olympic Games. I know going back to 1980 that video artists such as Namjoon Paik did video pieces that were shown around the Winter Olympics. And in this case, there's a number of things, but 11 sound artists' works are being presented in outdoor environments. 5 were specific commissions. 6 were just sort of works that were taken that kind of fit the bill. But I did a piece, it's called Whoosh, and it's using very, very, very fast close-up sounds of skis and skates and athletes going by.
Hmm.
And it's in an outdoor square in Bardonecchia, which I thought was going to be totally obscure and no one was going to go there. But then every time I turn on the Today Show in the morning, that's where Katie Couric seems to be
oh, really?
speaking from. So it's it's again about taking what's in a sense in the ambience, because it's not even in that space, but it's in the environment of the Olympics.
Do, I mean, is this set apart? Is it just playing? I mean, do people just wander into it?
They wander into it. It's on for 12 hours a day from like 9 in the morning till 9 at night.
And is there any information telling them what this is?
There is. You know, there's signposts, and mine is in one place. All these others are spread out.
Well, why Whoosh?
Whoosh because... I watched this incredible special or news piece actually about speed skiers as the fastest sport on earth.
Right. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Indie Radio, radio for the rest of us.
And when. As they were describing it and showing the guys going, they also talked about the sound, which was like a jet engine going by.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to capture that energy and that kind of, again, it's like an exaggerated detail, but it's this incredible energy of sound that the athletes create as they move.
How long
through
is
space.
Your piece?
It is 20 minutes, but you know, it's looping and
also speed skaters, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And really, I mean, another difference between installation for me and music. If I make something on a CD, I hope someone's going to sit down and listen for 54 minutes or 6 minutes to a track. With an installation, I realize that the average so-called viewer, listener, is just going to walk right through it. But then there's always a few who sort of seem to connect to what I'm doing who will stay longer. But I made a 20-minute piece just so that if you pass through it a few times, you're not hearing the same thing, and to keep it interesting for myself. But I know that you know, what's mostly happening is athletes are moving through the square or
so skiers going downhill make different sounds besides. I mean, I would sit here thinking,
sure,
you know, there's one sound they make, you know, whoosh. You
but
know,
but you can
but,
sort of,
but there isn't, obviously.
Yeah, there's, and there's details too.
So again, it's you as an archaeologist exploring the sound.
Exploring it and then taking poetic license.
Because it is so visual. I mean, you know, the Olympics to most of us is you sit in front of a television set, you know, and watch visual images of people. And that whole sound component, most of us miss. So
I think we miss on a critical intellectual level, but we would, if it actually was taken away, we totally realize, oh my
that's
God,
true.
It's gigantic. And,
yeah.
You know, I've been reading a book about sound people who worked for Hollywood over since sort of, you know, the beginning of the talkies to the present. And, you know, everybody says that the directors know if you want to change an image, what you have to do is change the sound. And I've experienced that many times where I've changed sound on a soundtrack and someone would say, wow, I remember this is very brown, and now I see that, you know, all I'm picking up is orange. You know, what did the video maker change in the color? And so he changed nothing. What we did was change the sound.
Change the sound.
And so, you know, if you go to a sporting event, you're very affected by the roar of the crowd, by the ambience of the hall.
We're much more, do you think, I think we're much more of a visual culture, I guess, than we are attuned.
I think we're a visual culture.
Yeah.
I mean, we are, for
sure. I mean,
sure.
We're in...
Yeah.
I don't know how to put that. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's for me, what happens is that visual is what we kind of intellectually take in and critique and we process. But sound is what we emotionally take in.
Yes,
and that
sound
not,
is sound is emotion.
It's absolutely emotional.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, visual certainly can be emotion, but sound, clearly... Well, I can't believe it, but...
we're out of time.
That was 30 minutes.
Ding,
ding, ding, right.
In a sense, cone of silence.
Well, thank you, really. The cone
thank
of silence will come back down again. Thank you very much. It was fascinating. I wish we had another half hour.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Anyway, again, this is Tim Bowring. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 Indie Radio, radio for the rest of us. Thank you for tuning in to Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you on the radio every first and third Monday of the month at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Indie Radio, radio for the rest of us.